Prior to this episode, I was told never ever confuse an Aussie with a Kiwi. I'm going to take that into consideration. Welcome back to the On Call Nightmares podcast. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. My name is Jay Gordon. This podcast is about stories from technologists and their experiences in On Call. So, once again, we've got another great conversation with a member of the technology industry. And today I was lucky enough to speak with JD Trask of Raygun. If you would like to, I recommend you go check out their product. I believe it is raygun.com. Let me double check. Yes, it's raygun.com. Sorry for doing this live, but sometimes you just got to do it live. I'll be honest, I'm a little checked out because I am going on vacation tomorrow. It's not something that I do a ton of, but I'll be honest, I got to be on the road a lot this year, so I've decided to take a little bit of my time and get it back to myself, because if I've learned anything about being in tech, it's that if you've been working for a long time and you need a vacation, you probably should take one. I believe that's probably a good idea, and I've really been bad about that over the years. I've worked at different companies that have offered me tons of time off, and unfortunately, I always have this idea that I don't have any time to take off. And to be honest, it's not true. I think that, especially when you're in a role where you're on call a lot, you tend to feel responsibility even when you are not responsible for things, and at least that's kind of stuck with me. Even years later, I kind of am always looking at my phone or checking my email to see if there's anything that I need to do. And in the present role I'm in, I really don't have to do things that are like an on-demand, on-call kind of role. So one thing that I've kind of felt is that there is a lasting impact that being on-call has on people. And I think that one of the things we've as an industry have done a little bit better is to no longer dismiss on-call work as just an extra thing that, you know, somebody has to do. It's important. And the more we look at things like SRE methodology and the idea that we just need to keep systems online and people are constantly doing something to improve the stability of systems, it's just a different way of thinking about it as compared to the way that I was introduced to, which was, look, when an alert goes off, just fix the alert, and then we'll worry about the big problem later on. And as many of us know, that kind of methodology doesn't work. So anyhow, if you've been listening, you know that every single time I do an episode, one of the things I'm going to ask you is to please get in touch with me to be part of the podcast. I am running short on new interviews, so that means I got to beg you all, if you'd like to be on the podcast, you can send me a email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. You can reach out to me on Twitter @oncallnightmare or @jdestro. So, just some personal notes. This week I got to go do a talk at Princeton University, and it was really, really cool. I talked a little bit about the cloud and Azure, since I work at Microsoft, and just got an opportunity to talk to some people who were, you know, in a computer science class and learning about these types of big ideas associated with running distributed systems, and so I was able to kind of go and give them a little rundown of the cloud. I think it's just always great when you get opportunities to introduce ideas that you're just trying to propagate maybe to the business world, also to people who are still learning about becoming members of the tech industry. So it was a cool opportunity. So anyway, let's get into the interview with JD Trask of Raygun. Hope you enjoy it. I really did like talking with him. Welcome back to the On Call Nightmares podcast. And once again, I'm here with another technologist who is going to give us some information stories and lessons learned from being on call. And today, we're going to speak with a CEO. I've been really lucky that CEOs, CTOs, and other C-level executives have given me some of their time. And once again, I've been lucky enough to get that of John Daniel Trask, who is well known as JD, as he likes to call himself and amongst friends. He's been programming since he was about 9 years old. And now he leads the Raygun business, where he's usually in New Zealand, but travels a bunch of places to speak at events. And while he doesn't code quite as much as he used to, he still loves to write code. So thanks for your time, JD.
Thank you very much for having me, Jay.
No problem. So let's kind of get started. We're not too familiar with one another, and that's fine. But I like to kind of open up when I don't know someone that well, trying to find out a little bit where you came from, how you got here, and where you think you're going next. So tell me kind of how you got started working in technology in an on-call role.
Yeah, sure. Well, I always like to frame the fact that I got into technology when I was a child because I remember learning QBasic on the family computer. And to me, it was like discovering a box of Lego with an unlimited number of pieces. Like I didn't have to beg and plead for mom and dad to buy me more. I could just imagine what I wanted to make and just write the code. And that was really cool. And even early on, funnily enough, in my teenage years, I started writing tools to do things like logging and try to point out defects and problems with things. I really felt like the quality of software was a bit of an issue. So I've always had a genuine passion for trying to see systems work and see them be more efficient and all of that sort of thing. And then you fast forward many, many years and ended up starting this company, Raygun, with my business partner, Jeremy Boyd, who's our CTO. And it was a SaaS business, so people pay a subscription and we track crashes and user monitoring and all that. The big thing, though, that was quite different from things that we'd done in the past was it was no longer a boxed product. It was an always-on service, right? And our customers were relying on us to be up and to send their data to help monitor their systems. And so it suddenly became a pretty big deal if there was an issue with the software. Mm-hmm. Now, we kind of got that. I mean, it's a whole value prop, right? Hey, we're going to tell you when something's broken. So it's pretty important the thing that does that works. It's kind of like you'd expect a black box flight recorder to work. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of had to put a lot of time into figuring out how are we going to do on call? How are we going to do the alerting? How are we going to handle the various laws in New Zealand, for example, where we're starting out for on-call, and just generally, even things like how do we document common parts of the system so somebody does get woken up in the night, you know, you don't want them having to reinvent the whole wheel just to try and get things online. And so we've had that system online now for about 5 or 6 years. We process about 150 million requests per hour through the platform on behalf of some of the world's largest companies. And so, and we take really, really seriously that that keeps working and it's reliable. So yeah, so that's kind of the soup to nuts.
Gotcha. So prior to those years, were you kind of part of an on-call rotation or a role, I guess, before you started the business?
I had been somewhat on call before I even started a business myself with a tech company that I worked at. They were based here in New Zealand. We had to do things like they had a lot of government clients, and this was in the really early 2000s. So a lot of things like continuous deployment and all that weren't really a thing. So we had to do stuff like, hey, we only do deployments at this like crazy hour of the night on a, you know, a Tuesday. We had that weird stuff. And then if something went wrong, they did have a particular ops team around it who would then contact you as a lead engineer on that. Follow through to when we started the business, and it was a small startup at the time. And so even though I was leading it, I put myself on call. In fact, I only took myself off call probably about a year ago, and I'm actually still in the I'm still in the pyramid there. So if it gets to me, it's pretty bad. But yeah, so I've done a little bit before when I think being on call was less structured and talked about, that sort of really end of the 90s sort of stuff, through to now where it's talked about a lot more and people seem to have a lot more structure to it, and there's better tooling and all of that sort of stuff. Literally back in the day in the early 2000s, we were talking about some folks still using actual pages, you know, things like that.
Sure. Yeah, I actually was a part of some really early rotations where I got just like a, what was barely even a BlackBerry. It was kind of a BlackBerry. It didn't really get phone calls. Like, when the calls came in, it never worked. So I just kind of looked at it as a two-way pager, and I just remember getting, like, alerts when, you know, something, whatever it was at this point, didn't work. So I definitely remember those early years of when before, I guess, technology had looked at on call and finally described it as work rather than a thing that some people just had to do. And it's been really big to watch on call be kind of justified as real work nowadays. And
I would say I've always thought it was real work because nobody really wanted to do it. So
if you let me clarify it, when I call it real work, a lot of times during we look at project work and things that move the needle day to day as like the big meat and the potatoes of getting things done. And then we look at that toil that comes along with operational work as, you know, it's not moving things quite as much. And I really believe that actually from those years of being constantly within toil, a lot of us learned how not to be in that place anymore. And to start building automation or services that actually created a real on-call rotation.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
So that's what I mean like by real work. Like it used to be that on-call was somebody got an email or someone's phone got forwarded an email or something of that nature, and then a bunch of people jumped onto it. And I think that if you look from that, because I kind of know the period that you're talking about, like that 01, 02, 03 years where on-call was a thing, but we didn't call it anything else, but you're on rotation, it's your turn.
Yep. The one thing I think it's, as it's been maturing is we've seen it sort of help lift the awareness of investing in tools around observability, helping get to that resolution quicker, because if something – you can guarantee something will at some point go wrong. Okay, once we acknowledge that, we then need to know how do we make sure that when it goes wrong, where we can resolve it quickly. There's also a general management sort of ethos that I subscribe to beyond just being on call, which is the people who can fix the pain need to be the people who feel the pain. And I think this is often a little small smidgen of like the DevOps related stuff. It's like the accountability side. And that's why, you know, until fairly recently, it was a case where I was quite comfortable being in the rotation. I still had the skills to actually help out most of the time. I really only came off because I ended up being traveling, meeting with customers and things like that too much to actually be able to respond reliably. So having that accountability go up and people actually appreciate, hey, we've put this thing out there. And I mentioned I have a general passion for increasing the quality of software and user satisfaction. I think we just see more and more businesses saying, hey, this can't be an afterthought. You know, we can't have our software just delivering poor value all the time. And fortunately, that's hopefully leading to that increase in not burning people out on things like on-call.
Yeah, and I think that that's been one of the great things about the increase in tools to help people is that by taking a greater look at systems and the alerts that they produce, you can now start saying, well, these alerts aren't necessary. These alerts really aren't necessary. They're not going to do anything. It's great that we're using X amount of CPU. We're supposed to be. Let's not wake people up for that. And so I think that's been the biggest change for me is like, and I've had this conversation, is that one, I think when you move away from the template, when you're looking at systems and you look more for what's actually important, not what's just templatized, it gets easier and smarter. And that's what I've learned that businesses seem to be doing, is taking away how generic things are and making sure that monitoring observability meets the system that it's actually monitoring or observing.
Totally agree. I think that's also where I think people like to think the AI ops stuff is going, but in the reality, I think in the near term anyway, it's not going to quite deliver on that vision. We've seen, for example, customers who, they have a rough template. They know that there's, say, behaviors in their systems that occur. And then, say, we had one e-commerce customer where Black Friday comes along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't take into account, is this normal for this time last year? You know, it looks last week, last month, you know, yesterday. And went, no, this is not normal. And started to, one of their systems started to behave like they were under some sort of attack, you know. So getting a bunch of those things, be more understanding of the behavior of our software is really important.
Makes sense. So at this point in the podcast, I normally like to get into the rules. And the rules of the podcast are pretty simple. So we'd like to ask you a story from being on call, whether it's while you've been in an executive position as the business started or something from a previous role. And what we ask you is, one, we're going to follow the DevOps methodology of being blameless. So we will not incriminate yourself. We won't incriminate others because, you know, you tell stories, you don't want to put that name in, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Joe Blow's not hireable anymore. So we'll avoid putting those names. And then also, whatever story you do tell us, let's learn something from that. So help us learn from a situation in which you were on call and it sucked and you made it not suck in the long term.
Sure. The one that springs to mind, this is from a few years ago, and I certainly won't be incriminating anybody because it ultimately it turned out to be an issue which literally wasn't really any single person's responsibility anyway. It was just one of those perfect storms where certain behaviors across various parts of the system came to be. But I'm jumping ahead to the retrospective. So it was, like I say, about 3 or 4 years ago. We're running this always on service. Obviously, it's really important to have high API availability at that point. I mentioned we ingest a lot of data for customers. We predominantly use Microsoft.NET on most of our backend for the Raygun service. But at the time, this was pre.NET Core. We were using Node.js for the API layer, because the API layer would auto expand and do all sorts of things, scale out as based on load, and we wanted them to be Linux boxes and all that good stuff. So first thing to note there is one piece of the stack there is not sort of our core strength. People were comfortable with it, but it wasn't something we deeply, deeply understood. And then I was at a conference in Dublin, Ireland, which was a really awesome city, my first time there, and with some of the team. And I actually forget who was the first line that got pinged on call, but it was somebody at the event with me. We were fortunate enough to be after the event, but we had gone out for a celebration dinner. And so this person did have their, you know, their laptop backpack with them because they knew they were on call. Probably should have just passed that on to somebody back home in New Zealand at that point, knowing we were going to be out. But we started to see that the API layer was not keeping up and scaling kind of like super crazily, behaving really, really bizarre. And so we thought, oh, okay, you know, maybe we've got what we call a pumper. You know, when we first launched the product, I think it was the third largest Facebook game at the time integrated us as like number two customer and blew us off the internet. So sometimes we kind of saw these things and we'd go, oh, somebody huge has come along. Today we have lots of huge customers and that's fine, but thought maybe it's just that. So you kind of thought, okay, there's got to be some sort of rate limiting or something that just needs to be applied here and we'll all go back to working out. And so this person had a look, applied, you know, went looking for this app and couldn't actually see that there was any app that was causing an issue, right? So hang on a minute, this thing's auto-scaling because of crazy CPU usage. What's going on here? But then as it was auto-scaling, it wasn't actually dealing with any more data. So then they started going, why is it not actually able to deal with more data? And so at this point, we were also quite fortunate that the team in New Zealand were actually online. So we're headquartered in New Zealand, but we have we have offices around the world today. But at the time, so we could start talking to some more of the engineers and say, hey, are you folks seeing this? Well, any ideas? Like, this seems really bizarre. And so where we got to is at this point, we'd been like 25 minutes in and we were starting to drop quite a lot of data and, you know, oh, okay, nothing super obvious is standing out, which I'm sure you know that sort of sinking feeling where you kind of go, oh, no, it's a whole new class of problem, right? What are we going to do?
You're looking at, you know, I know when you're, like, looking at the error logs on certain types of things and you're begging for a specific error to pop up so you can put some sort of, like, reasonable like cause. But then you realize, like, oh, I've been here for 15 minutes. That error hasn't popped up in the log. It's time to pivot.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So at this point, I decided to basically shut down the dinner that we're having in Dublin. We went back to the hotel. We set up an ad hoc war room in one of the rooms. We all set up the machines. We then used one of the laptops to dial in some of the engineers in New Zealand so that we kind of had this this group conversation able to go. We then said, okay, well, look, if we can't spot what is actually the issue here, so rather than having, say, five or six people all looking at the same potential things, let's try and divide this work up. Let's somebody go and have a look. Is there any other piece of our infrastructure that is looking anomalous in our sort of server logs? You know, can somebody actually see from the little bit of data coming through from error logs, is there anything in there that seems new or interesting? Can somebody else go and have, you know, a look at some of the raw payloads that have been received? Is there something different in the data we're receiving? And so we kind of went off and did this. And after about 15 minutes or so, sort of, and again, keep in mind, there's kind of a live mic in the room. So we're all able to talk as we're sort of going. Sure. And one of the team noticed that, sure enough, one of the databases was running super, super hot, right? Just seemed to be maxed out. And you're like, oh, okay.
Either the database or DNS, it's one or the other.
And then we're like, oh, all right. So what's happening here? And so we thought, oh, I bet the issue is that when we receive data, it comes in with an API key header to know how to route the data to a customer's account, right? Mm-hmm. So we're like, we must be hitting this database on every single request. We mustn't have an appropriate level of caching that's occurring in these API nodes to improve this.
And what kind of database were you using?
This was a MySQL database hosted with an Amazon on an RDS instance.
Gotcha. There.
And it was a fairly grunty database, though. So we were kind of surprised that for something that would even be quite a simple lookup. And so we, you know, one of the team who works on the API went away and was like, he was less convinced than everybody else about this, starts digging in, and it's like, no, there absolutely is caching in here. You know, I can, I'm putting in additional logging. I'm deploying these things. I can see it's hitting the cache like crazy. It's like, oh, okay, that's no good. And then as we kind of draw to the end of the story, fortunately, one of the team rightly sort of – there's this great – I don't know if you know who Charlie Munger is. He's the deputy chairman of Berkshire Hathaway's, Warren Buffett's offsider, and he has all this great stuff about biases and how to think about things. And one of his rules that he says all the time is whatever it is, always invert. Always try to think of the reverse. And this guy seemed to demonstrate that exact skill where he said, but what if it's not a customer's API key? Right? Like, what if there isn't an app with that ID in existence? And so, of course, we'd been looking there at the caching. Okay, the keys come through. They check the cache. It returns this. What we weren't doing, had never put into the API, was the idea that if we received data for, say, an app that had been deleted, that we should actually cache that to say, we've had a look, it doesn't exist.
So you had all these misses. I totally understand.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it was like, oh my goodness. One large user had deleted an app that was sending a lot of data. And what had happened is then the contention point had become the database because it was smashing this thing over and over, but finding no results, coming back, but having to do it, which just also like meant
an agent sending data and it having a place to actually send the data, but the connection is still received regardless, something like that.
It's still receiving and saying, it would say, the API would basically receive it and say, okay, the API, the app that this is meant to be sending into, say it's ID 123, go and get me that from the database. Whoop, there's no 123 in the database, so drop the data.
And but we weren't then call every single
time. Ooh. And then what would happen is that the database was then maxed out, just dealing with basically nonsense queries returning nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And then trying to scale out the API, which only then put more pressure on it, slowed everything down and all of that. And so it was really interesting to see that mental mechanic of kind of going, no, why don't we're kind of checking the obvious, but now we have to start to try and flip this around. Like, what's the not obvious here? So that, and within, I think, 10 minutes later, you know, we'd shipped a quick fix for that, where we cached on failed responses. The load went right back down. That database, as I recall, dropped to about 3% CPU utilization. Everything was good to go again, which was great. So that was the kind of the core run through there. I don't think we would have resolved that nearly as quickly if we didn't have that opportunity to kind of bring everybody together, treat it with the seriousness that was going on, that we could all converse about it quite freely. Now, I know that's not something that's easy to do when you're on call and it's 3 a.m. and you don't really want to, you know, we've all even had that escalation moment, right? Where you kind of go,
yeah,
starting to think I might be out of my depth, but.
When you're in an early portion of a business, which it sounds like you are, I think that you don't necessarily have the privilege of waiting it out, because
yep.
Every moment that you wait out is a death to your own business.
Yep, absolutely. And so that was the thing at the time. And it still is. I mean, we treat this stuff really, really seriously. We're fortunate now that we've improved a whole lot. And some of the key things in the retrospective that we did well after the fact was to sort of say, hey, we have really great monitoring in place for everything, but we had been a bit lax on doing it at our API layer because of the lack of familiarity, right? Mm-hmm. We were at that point a very early stage business. Now we're a fair bit more significant, so we do have a lot more maturity in there. But you know, a lot of the time people forget that to get to maturity, you have to go through immaturity, right? You're finding the weak spots, you're having the retros, you're making a change based on the outcomes, and you're slowly getting better and stronger constantly. So there was
that's DevOps, right? That iteration, yep. That process.
Absolutely. And it's the way, you know, I think that's one of my superpowers in the CEO role these days. I've got a deep understanding of how we try and attack problems in engineering and software delivery and ops. And I just treat that exactly the same way for business decisions. How do we, really the key is how quickly can we iterate and how quickly can we be delivering value? And really nothing else kind of matters that much. If you can do that, you're gonna win in the long run.
Makes sense.
Yeah. We also then had benefits down the road where, for example, Microsoft did come out with .NET Core and have a great story for multi-platform. We did want to keep Linux on those boxes, and mm-hmm. so we shifted that to .NET Core, which meant now more of the team had a deeper understanding and experience level with that. This was no this issue that we had was no criticism of Node, as I've explained the problem. It was nothing to do with the programming language at all. But anything that's kind of maybe makes those on-call folks or anybody working on an issue maybe feel a little less confident is going to slow down that ability to find resolution.
Sure.
So that was a win.
And that's a really, really good piece of advice, which I like to ask, you know, during the podcast, like, what's a piece of advice to a person that's on call that you would give? And aside from that, is there already another specific thing that you think you could tell someone who's maybe, you know, going to receive pages? What's a great piece of advice you can give them?
Yeah, well, I'd go back on a point I sort of touched on earlier, and I see this a lot when you're bringing folks into rotation for the first time, right? They're often incredibly apprehensive, so buddying them up with somebody that mm-hmm. so that they are very, very aware that they're on call with somebody else to begin with, because oftentimes they, at least in our business, these people might really well understand certain areas of the solution, but they might not understand some other areas quite so well. They may have an academic understanding of it. So making them feel safe. Also, I make sure that we never talk negatively about something being escalated, right? Mm. I would always make it clear to folks as the CEO, I'm more likely to be frustrated that somebody was afraid to escalate and an issue went on too long than somebody who didn't really want to frustrate a coworker. That's right. We're all in this together. What we really care about is that customer experience and that gets back to great as quickly as possible. So I oftentimes spend most of the tips is just really making those new folks that are coming on board feel safe, know that they're not really going to annoy somebody else by escalating them. You know, we're all trying to paddle the boat in the same direction.
Sure. And as a co-founder of a business, and I've been asking, you know, I asked another co-founder recently when they decide they're ready to come on call. And you know, they didn't really know when they were ready. So as a person who founded a business, was on call as part of the technology, when did you feel like you were ready to kind of let go about that little bit of control over the business and say, we've got the processes? What did it take, would you say, to actually say, I don't need to be on the rotation anymore?
I think it was twofold. One was when I started to be concerned that wasn't bringing enough value to that role. Like if I wasn't physically able to be on call, for example, if I'm sitting in a sales meeting with a customer, I can't hardly get out my laptop, you know, and start working on it. Like if I'm going to drop the ball, not be a team player, everybody has those moments when they're on call where they can't pick up. Like I get that. But when it was becoming a greater percentage of my time than felt right, it was that. And secondly, as the team got large enough of people that were comfortable being in that on-call pool as to make it feel like I wasn't sort of upping the workload by, say, 25%, you know. It wasn't when I was one of the four falling out. It was kind of going, oh, actually, there's say, 8 or 9 folks now doing this. Are they really going to miss me even if, you know, if I wasn't on there? So there's that. I also make sure, though, that I stay in things like our on-call Slack channels and I talk with the team about the any issues that do arise, and I make sure I'm up to date on that sort of stuff though. So I haven't sort of just thought this is nothing for me to care about. I always think issues, like I say, it goes back to when I was a kid, right? Even when I was writing code for myself, I always wanted to understand the quality and make sure it was the best quality outcome.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Well, you know what? Thank you very much, JD. I really, really appreciated your time for this interview. I'm glad to have talked to someone from literally the other side of the planet today. So thank you very much for getting up a little early. If you'd like to get in touch with JD, you can find him on Twitter. It's TraskJD, TraskJD. Obviously, there's the business. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Raygun?
Yeah, so Raygun launched, like I say, about 5 or 6 years ago as a software crash reporting solution. Takes about 10 minutes to integrate, records all of your errors, groups them up, gives you workflow and dashboards and all of that stuff. It also does real user monitoring, so tracking the end user's experience in terms of load times and really helping you identify when you have performance issues that are making the user's life terrible. And then more recently, we added an APM product similar to what you might see from the likes of New Relic, but with a dramatically better pricing model where we bill on a per trace basis. And we also analyze the inbound traces to create issues. So copying what we did with crash reporting, you know, identifying things like N+1 issues and common mistakes that people make, grouping them up and allowing you workflow tools around that. So it's all about trying to make the software better, which, like I say, is a big reason why it's really important that we stay up and keep working, because if we have a problem, we might be causing problems for other on-call teams.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you very much for your time today, JD. Hopefully I'm going to start wrapping up my day here in New York City while you start yours out in New Zealand. And it was really great talking to you. And thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you, Jay. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Awesome. So we'll be right back to the end of the On-Call Nightmares podcast for this week. Stick around. We'll be right back.
That's it for this week.
thank you very much, JD. I really appreciated your time. And if you'd like to be on the podcast, real simple, just send me an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com or send a tweet my way or a DM at jdestro or at oncallnightmare. So we'll catch you next time on another episode of On Call Nightmares. Enjoy your time and make sure that all of your alerts stay green. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.